Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable, when we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. It's been 1 year since the brutal murder of the Washington Post's Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. The insider turned critic of the Saudi government entered the consulate a year ago with his fiancée outside, but he never exited. And a year later, no one has been held responsible for the crime, and Saudi Arabia has refused to cooperate with the United Nations investigation into it. Today, we're joined by award-winning Frontline correspondent Martin Smith to discuss the crime, the investigation, and the young Saudi monarch at the center of it all in his new PBS documentary, The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. The documentary examines the rise to power of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, as well as his ties to the murder, handling of dissent, and relationship with the Trump administration. Now, you can watch the two-hour documentary on PBS, and we link to it on yourcallradio.org, where you can also watch the trailer. But we're pleased to have us, by phone from New York City, with Martin Smith, an Emmy-winning correspondent and 25-year producer for PBS's Frontline. Martin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. How are you?
Good. We're glad you can be with us for this first segment of Your Call's weekly media roundtable. Later in the show, we're going to be joined by Slate technology writer April Glazer to discuss a new court ruling upholding a Trump administration rollback of Obama-era net neutrality laws governing the internet. So stay tuned for that in the second half of the show. And you can join this conversation. We'll be opening up the phone lines in about 15 minutes or so, and you can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. But you can send us an email in the meantime to yourcall@kalw.org, or better yet, you can leave your comment on our website at yourcallradio.org. So, Martin, October 2nd of this week marked the one-year anniversary of Jamal Khashoggi's gruesome murder at the Saudi embassy in Istanbul, and it's still hard to believe that he was killed in such a horrific manner. He was tortured, his body was cut up into pieces, all with his fiancée waiting for him outside. Saudi Arabian officials first lied about it, that he had left the consulate when it turned out he hadn't. And a year later, no one has been held responsible for the crime. As I mentioned, Saudi Arabia has refused to cooperate with the United Nations investigation. And the CIA, meanwhile, has concluded that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the killing. So can you tell us, where is the investigation now into his murder a year later?
Well, we're dealing with an extraordinarily opaque regime in Saudi Arabia. And so it is very hard to know where their investigation is, if indeed they really have one. They have put at least nine of the people that flew in, out of the 15 that flew into Istanbul, on trial, perhaps a few more. But there's no report. There are no reporters or public that are allowed into the courtroom. It's an enormously closed process. And they have made the conclusion that it's impossible for the higher-ups, especially Mohammed bin Salman, whose own security team and bodyguards and one of his close aides are implicated in the murder. They say it's impossible that he would have authorized this. They say this even though the investigation, they claim, is incomplete and not finished. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. As far as anybody else being able to investigate further than the UN special rapporteur, Agnes Callamard, I mean, she wasn't able to go into Saudi Arabia or get cooperation from the Saudis. She wasn't able to get much cooperation at all from the United States. So this calls for more investigation. That's the conclusion that I think we reach. But the question is, who can do that? Who will do that? Will it be the International Criminal Court or the UN? We don't know.
So are these international processes through the UN, are they just effectively on hold then, waiting for further cooperation from Saudi Arabia or from the United States or somewhere else?
Well, I think it's going to take more than waiting. It's going to take pressure, and it's going to take some urgency coming out of other states, other countries. Right now, the Trump administration has pretty much stood by the Crown Prince, regardless of the conclusion of the CIA that he most likely ordered this. So as long as Trump is in the White House, you're not going to get cooperation out of the U.S. If Congress can't force it. As far as the U.N., that's going to require other member states to pressure for a really official investigation, further investigation of the crime.
And but was there official conclusion? Sure, go ahead.
You know, I was just going to add that this is about far more than Jamal Khashoggi. Jamal Khashoggi, unfortunately, is no longer with us, but there are people sitting, languishing in Saudi jails who have been arrested for incredibly specious charges, such as talking to foreign reporters or talking to human rights groups. There's women activists, writers, academics, clerics who are in jail, some facing death penalty, some having no charges filed against them at all. So it's a much broader problem than just the investigation of Jamal Khashoggi's murder.
I think that's an important point. And your Frontline special described many of these stories in anguishing detail, including women who have been put in prison simply for driving against the ban on women driving. But just going back to this issue about where the investigation is now, did the UN actually come to any sort of conclusion in terms of what happened at this point? And what about Turkey? I mean, this all happened, you know, in the Saudi consulate in Turkey on their soil. Where do they stand in all of this as well?
You know, I don't know what the Turks' official position is here, but clearly they have been contributing, helping. They've allowed intelligence services around the world to listen to the audio tapes the audio that was recorded inside the consulate. As far as the UN, Agnes Callamard is a volunteer. She works as a special rapporteur for investigation of extrajudicial killings. She covers the world. She was given one trip to Turkey, paid for by the UN. But outside of that, it's a volunteer effort, and she filed the most in-depth report to date and concluded that it was a state killing. It was premeditated, but you know, as far as an official high-level human investigation by the UN, we haven't seen that yet.
So you went to Saudi Arabia just 3 months after Khashoggi's assassination, and you met with Mohammed bin Salman, and you met with other allies in his inner circle, and you say that the Crown Prince wanted to put the murder behind him, or that's what he informed you. But can you talk a little bit about what you found out on that trip? It was pretty remarkable to see your level of access in the Frontline documentary.
I've been going there for quite a while, and I take it that they had this big sporting event with big music concerts, and they felt like if they invited a few journalists and took the risk, they might contribute to putting this whole thing behind them. And I think that's a miscalculation on their part. I think here we are a year later, and still this isn't going away. I think that surprised them. That's what I heard from Saudi officials, that sense of being surprised that this wasn't, you know, they considered this an internal matter, that Jamal Khashoggi, who had been very much an insider, and somebody who had defended the regime in the past, had turned on them. And so they felt that this was a betrayal by one of their own. So they don't invite a lot of journalists in. They're trying to, right now they're rolling out this new these new tourist visas, and they're trying to go forward with what's called Vision 2030, this plan to revitalize the economy and open up the country. At the same time, they're continuing to crack down on political rights of all kinds, free speech, right to self-determination, right of assembly. I think they have severely underestimated the impact of this most gruesome murder that captured everybody's imagination. I mean, Hatice Cengiz and Jamal Khashoggi went to the consulate just to get marriage papers. So he went there out of love, and he ends up cut up into pieces. We don't know quite. We've heard theories about where the body is, but it's captured people's imagination, and people are not letting go.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Khashoggi. Now, he was an insider, and he was a cheerleader for the new crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, as he's referred to, at least here in the U.S. And then he became a critic. But can you describe a bit about what turned MBS, the crown prince, against Jamal? Like, what happened to set this in motion for Khashoggi?
It's very interesting and very surprising that it was right after the election of 2016. Trump becomes president of the United States, and Jamal goes on a video conference into a think tank in Washington, and he gives this rather mild cautionary note about how the Saudis ought to be careful, or people ought to be careful about, as he said then, putting all their eggs in one basket, that, you know, Trump is an unknown quantity and we should be careful. That was the extent of it. The result was that he got a phone call, he told his friends, that told him that he could no longer write, tweet, or appear on television. He was silenced. And that's what set it in motion, that he had somehow, in the perception of the crown prince, stepped between the Saudi regime and the Trump administration. It wasn't for criticism initially of MBS. He was a supporter of MBS. He was optimistic, but yet criticizing Trump, who MBS saw as a ally and was looking forward to his working together with him, that was too much. That was a red line. He crossed it.
And then what happened after that? Because it seems like he took on a much bigger profile at that point once he was sort of, you know, put on this suspension for these remarks. It seemed like he then really raised the ire of the Saudi monarchy.
Well, he was silenced for months upon months upon months. And so finally he decided that that was untenable for him. So he decided to leave Saudi Arabia and move to Virginia. And he... I met him there after he had left, and he was sort of musing at that moment, as you'll see it in the documentary, about what he was going to do with his life and what he was going to do next. And a few weeks after that, he decided what he was going to do, and that was to write a column for the Washington Post. And at that point, he had witnessed the arrests of many people that he knew, and he was quite disturbed. I think the title of his first article ran along the lines of Saudi Arabia was always bad, but it's unbearable now.
And do you think there was anything else going on behind the scenes? I mean, it just seems like such a disproportionate way to crack down. I mean, it's extraordinary to crack down on a citizen outside of their borders like this. But was anything else, or was it just the high public profile he had as a critic in the Washington Post that sort of sealed his demise here?
Well, I think that it's one thing for an American columnist or a European columnist to write critical articles about the crown prince, but this was somebody that they all knew. This was somebody who was a spokesperson for the embassy in the Saudi embassy in London, and then later in Washington. This was somebody, as you say, an insider, very much one of them, and they just couldn't stomach having him in Washington, a major U.S. capital of their major, most important ally, the United States, criticizing Saudi Arabia. So the conversations that were captured on intercepts by the National Security Agency make it clear that Mohammed bin Salman was very disturbed about the influence that he was gaining by writing this column in the Washington Post. So he, at one point, said to an aide, you know, we should go get him, and if we can't get him, we should show him a bullet.
Well, if you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable. We're talking to Emmy Award-winning Frontline correspondent Martin Smith to discuss his new PBS documentary, The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, which examines the rise to power of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, as well as his ties to the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, handling of dissent and his relationship with the Trump administration. We want to open the phone lines now if you have questions about this incident, about Saudi Arabia, about the news coverage of Trump administration and Saudi Arabian relations. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on our website at yourcallradio.org. Well, Martin, I want to ask you about the real subject of your PBS Frontline special, which is the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. And he's been portrayed as a leader with a modernizing, liberalizing agenda, a reformer, younger, really tapping into the sort of millennial and Gen Z rising generation in Saudi Arabia. But can you talk a little bit about this use of the term reform and reformer in Saudi Arabia? I mean, we've heard this to some extent in years past, but what exactly does that mean? And what is your take on MBS and his status and or his image as a reformer?
Yeah, it's an excellent question because I think there's a lot of confusion over this idea of him being a reformer and what that means. He is a reformer. He does want to open up the country to a degree. He wants to revitalize the economy. They've been totally dependent on oil revenue. He wants to diversify away from oil. And in order to get those economic reforms in place, he feels he needs to do some social reforms. He needs to give women better place in the economy. He needs them. He needs them to be in the workforce. What it doesn't mean, and this is where the confusion is, it doesn't mean political rights. It doesn't mean freedom of speech. It doesn't give people the right to publish an independent newspaper. So it's on something of a China model where you have a vital economy, but you maintain an iron grip on the population and what they are saying or doing. So there was a confusion in the U.S. Everybody saw this reformer, and yeah, he's young and he's energetic. He's the first of his generation to come close to power in Saudi Arabia. So they people, I think, have a tendency to see what they want to see, and so they took this idea of him being a reformer, and he romanced political circles, Silicon Valley, Hollywood. A lot of people were impressed.
You have a lot of shots in your special on Frontline with him, with people like Bill Gates and Tim Cook and Thomas Friedman, et cetera. So to your point about his ability to network within the U.S. Sort of elites and opinion shapers. But I want to ask about what you make of his ultimate goal in all of these reforms. Is this about military power? He's engaged in this conflict with Yemen, a sort of proxy war against Iran. Is this about economic diversity, as maybe the world is moving away from oil, which has really been the entire backbone of the Saudi economy, and he's trying to diversify? I mean, what do you think he's really trying to do with his vision for the country through these reforms?
I think it's both of those things. I think he wants to make Saudi Arabia a viable nation state moving forward. Everybody's known that Saudi Arabia can't continue to depend wholly on oil. The United States doesn't need Saudi oil at this point. However, the world does, and will for some time to come. And if Saudi Arabia were to, well, if Aramco was to go down, I mean, it would have a huge impact on the world economy. But in the future, they've got to diversify their economy if they want to remain viable. He also wants to be the dominant player in the region. He wants to beat back Iran. Iran has been successful in working with proxy groups from Iraq and Syria and Lebanon and of course, Yemen. And Saudi Arabia really has no answer for that. And Saudi Arabia, as a monarchy, has nothing really to attract people to them. They're not a democratic state. So they're struggling to figure out how to make and keep this younger generation engaged. So it's a kind of a bread and circus situation where you're going to get a lot of the goodies that you want and entertainment along with it, but you're not going to be allowed to participate in power sharing in any meaningful way.
Well, I think your comparison to China sounds very apt in that context. Well, let's go to the phone lines, and we have Maria Luis joining us from Palo Alto by phone. So, Maria Luis, welcome to your call.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Yes, I am calling with a little bit of side question, and it is that 6 or 7 years ago, I heard a report on BBC where it was said that a Saudi prince had killed his manservant in London, and he was apparently flown out of London immediately. Now, this has not been heard, as far as I know, anywhere since then. And I just can't keep it to myself. So now I've said it.
Okay. Well, Marie-Louise, thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
So question for Martin then. Martin, is this an incident that you're aware of?
Well, I might be aware of it if I knew the name and the details of it. We've looked at a lot of these situations. There was a prince who had a drug addiction. They came in and flew him out of the UK immediately. He was a son of a prominent Saudi. There's been a number of renditions, even in the last or let's say kidnappings in the last year. And one of those people is still missing. It's not unusual for the Saudis to go and fetch somebody that they think is either speaking out or misbehaving or could be an embarrassment to the regime in some way, shape, or form, and bringing them back. So it is, in fact, something the United States did, of course, after 9/11 and rendered a number of people from places they were to third party locations where they could be interrogated and tortured. So the Saudis have done this. So it doesn't surprise me what the caller is talking about, and it may be a case that we have in our notes. There were a number of these, and we tried to include a kind of a small chapter in the film on this, but we were bursting at the seams, and we were already 2 hours long, and that's all we could do. But it's not surprising.
All right. Well, thank you, Maria Luis, for that question and an incident that you related. And you know, in terms of what actually happens kind of within the elites, within the royal family in Saudi Arabia, you know, I'm curious about how he was able to rise to power. And you talk about this in the Frontline special. But can you describe a bit about his rise? Because he was not in line otherwise to assume this position that of rule that he's in now. So how did this all come about?
His father was the governor of Riyadh for something like 50 years. And in 2015, he became the king. Being governor of Riyadh is a very powerful position. Riyadh province is the center of Saudi power. The origins of the Al Saud dynasty emanate from there. And so he was governor for 50 years. He has a son, the oldest son of his third wife, and somehow he took a liking to him. We don't know a whole lot about his early years, but we do know that the young Prince Mohammed was his father's favorite, and he looked at him and groomed him. Most young royals will go abroad and study, and the young Prince Mohammed bin Salman did not. He stayed close by his father throughout all these years, and when his father became the king in 2015, he immediately put him in the line of succession. He was only 29 years old. He was made Minister of Defense. He immediately went to work, launched the war in Yemen, and he began work on his quote-unquote Vision 2030. And those became both signature issues for him. So it was his father, and then his father eventually moved other people out of the way, helped young Salman rise to become from deputy crown prince to crown prince. And so by 2017, he's the crown prince by the end of 2017, or by the beginning of 2017.
So this is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar. You're listening to Your Call's weekly media roundtable, and we're talking to Martin Smith, Emmy-winning frontline correspondent with a new PBS documentary, The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. Phone lines are open, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255 if you want to join this conversation. And Martin, in terms of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's rise here, one of the things that was interesting to me about your Frontline special was how he really turned on his own family and turned on the business elites. Was this a pretty unusual step? I mean, a lot of the people you interviewed said, you know, that Saudi Arabia was not a police state, and now it's sort of turning into one. And my question is that accurate, or is it just that now finally the elites within Saudi Arabia are starting to feel the pinch as MBS is rising to power and consolidating that power?
Well, it's an absolute monarchy, and they exercise power as they see fit and always have. There have been periods in the past since the founding of the kingdom in 1932 of liberalization, and then there have been crackdowns and reversals. But there's nobody that I've talked to who would disagree with the notion that this is very different, that the crackdown of Mohammed bin Salman on people he perceived to be dissidents, as well as princes and well-connected businessmen, is unprecedented. And yes, there's a lot of corruption in Saudi Arabia, and that's why they said they cracked down on these businessmen and princes. But it was also a consolidation of power, and in a way that I think hasn't been seen in Saudi Arabia in previous years.
And what's been the role of the Trump administration in all of this? What's their attitude about the Crown Prince, and what are they getting out of all this?
So the Trump administration from the very beginning was dedicated to reversing the nuclear deal that Obama administration had worked to put into place, and to back the Saudi Arabians as their main ally in the region, and to help them beat back Iranian initiatives across the region. And in return, the Crown Prince promised to help the son-in-law of President Trump, Jared Kushner, with his sort of stillborn peace deal that he came to office talking about between the Palestinians and the Israelis. So there was a kind of quid pro quo there that, you know, we'll help you beat back Iran, you help us with this peace deal, we'll sell you weapons, we'll help you with the war in Yemen. The Trump administration, very transactional about this, saw the arms deals as jobs in the U.S. for the U.S. defense industry. The Saudis saw it as a way to continue the war in Yemen. So it was a very tight relationship. And, you know, most presidents make their first trip abroad. They go to Europe or they go to Canada or Mexico. President Trump, at the urging of Jared Kushner, decided to make his first foreign trip to Saudi Arabia. And you'll see it in the documentary. They roll out the red carpet in a way that they haven't done for previous presidents. It's quite remarkable scene. And all the way along in the subsequent months and years, every time Prince Salman makes a move, he gets a congratulatory tweet out of President Trump or a phone call. And so when the Jamal Khashoggi murder happens, the president says, we're standing by him. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but we're sticking with the Saudis. So all the way along, the Trump administration has attached itself at the hip to the Crown Prince.
Yeah, and certainly we've seen U.S. leaders be very close to the Saudis and be reluctant to criticize them, but it does seem like an unusually close relationship there. And we've just got a little less than a minute left, but I just have to ask you, you had really remarkable access. As you mentioned, you're one of the few journalists invited in to Saudi Arabia to talk to the Crown Prince. Are you worried that your access is a bit burned now with the release of this documentary? And is there concern that journalists like yourself might be targeted by the regime in other ways, hopefully not the way that Jamal was, Khashoggi was targeted, but that there might be repercussions for you given the lengths that this regime seems to be going to crack down on any sort of negative news?
Well, I'm not worried about burning bridges. I mean, one has to go in and do one's job and tell the truth as you see it and then let the chips fall where they may. But certainly the Saudis already have, over this last year, been very cautious about admitting reporters from the New York Times or the Washington Post. Only a few can get in. And so it's already been difficult. I don't know that this will make a big difference in that. It might. I don't expect they're going to be inviting me back in, or that I'm going to even apply to go back in at this point. So we'll just have to see. But one can't worry too much about that. I mean, my job is to, as best I can, tell the truth and just as I said, let the chips fall where they may.
Well, thank you for doing your job. Congratulations on the documentary. It's The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, airing on PBS's Frontline, available linked to on our website at yourcallradio.org, so you can check it out there. But Martin Smith, thank you so much for joining us by Skype from New York City. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, and we'll be back just after this short break. Well, for those of you just joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable. We're going to be joined in just a moment by Slate technology writer April Glazer to discuss a new court ruling upholding a Trump administration rollback of Obama-era net neutrality laws governing the Internet. But I want to let everyone know that we're podcasting this show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can always drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org, or you can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So now let's turn to our next segment. This week, for just a few hours, social media and news headlines shifted their attention from the ongoing Trump-Ukraine scandal and the impeachment inquiry in the House of Representatives to the administration's continued efforts to roll back another Obama-era regulation. Now, on Tuesday of this week, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals reaffirmed the Trump administration's repeal of net neutrality rules that were put in place by the Obama administration. And in doing so, the court agreed with the Federal Communications Commission's decision under the Trump administration to classify Internet service providers such as Comcast and AT&T in a way that allows them to prioritize our consumer access to certain content on the Internet over other information. Now, in a Slate article unpacking the decision, our guest April Glazer writes that without these regulations, Internet service providers like Comcast and AT&T can charge what's essentially a two-way toll, collecting monthly subscription fees from users and charging websites to access those users faster. Now, to get a better sense of this major development and what it means for consumers, we're very pleased to be joined by Skype by April Glazer, Slate technology writer and co-host of the podcast If Then. Welcome, April. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. And just to correct, I'm not co-hosting If Then anymore. There's going to be some exciting changes for that for listeners, but it's great to be here. Thank you.
All right. Well, breaking news then on your call, and we'll look forward to the next chapter for your podcast. So we'll open the phone lines up in just about 10 minutes for questions for April, but you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. But as I mentioned, the number to call in is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So April, before we dive in and talk about this court decision, can you just explain to listeners what net neutrality is, what the Obama administration did through the FCC, and why this matters to, or should matter to people, why we should care about this?
Sure. So in brief, net neutrality is the principle that internet providers that you pay a monthly subscription fee to, so Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, Sonic locally in San Francisco, for example, should not pick winners and losers in terms of what you're able to access online. So they shouldn't be able to block access to certain websites, nor should they be able to speed up access to certain websites and slow down access to others. And that can be done through a variety of ways. They could say, you know, charge a website a fee to reach users faster, therefore making kind of a two-tiered internet. And let's face it, when a website loads slower, you're going to navigate somewhere else. And you know, a consequence of that could be, for example, the New York Times loads way faster than a local news website, and therefore we're not having our information needs served locally, or a government website loads slower, for example, than a corporate website that's hosting that information elsewhere and profiting off of it. I mean, these are just like examples of what could happen, but the idea here is that the internet should be a place that is a level playing field where we should be able to access all information equally. And if we don't do that, then corporations are able to control what we see and what we don't see. Now, under Obama, the FCC passed rules that enshrined these principles, prohibiting internet providers from blocking or throttling access to anything online. As soon as Trump became president, he put Ajit Pai, the new chairman of the FCC, into power. And one of the first things he did was begin the process of rescinding these rules so that internet providers can do whatever they want with how we connect to the internet and charge websites to reach us and also control what we see and what we don't see. So, for example, now that AT&T owns HBO, they could give free access to HBO for AT&T subscribers, therefore, you know, making it harder for a new video service to ever get off the ground, because why would an AT&T subscriber use something else? I mean, these are just examples, but it's in essence kind of privileging the information that's accessible to us. I'll add also that Ajit Pai was successful in repealing these rules, and so right now in the United States there are no net neutrality rules. And this was reaffirmed by a court this week. The decision was considered to be lawful. Internet providers can do as they please with how we connect to the internet, as long as they say in their terms of service that they reserve the right to do this.
And so when the Trump administration swept into power and Ajit Pai took over the FCC as chair, what was their rationale? Why did they want to undo these rules? I mean, you could obviously see a profit motive for some, but then there are potentially some other deeper pockets that might not be happy about this either. So what was their sort of, you know, their ideology or their rationale for pushing through this repeal?
Well, you know, it's certainly an interesting case because, you know, the large internet companies like, you know, Google or Facebook, they relied on, in order to ascend as they have, a level playing field. And so they're generally proponents of net neutrality, even though, you know, without rules that kind of give everybody a chance, they certainly can further entrench their power. But the rationale that Pai gave is that internet companies like Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T are disincentivized from building out their networks, that it prevents them from accessing new revenue streams, that it's an undue regulatory burden. And it seems like the ideology behind the repeal of net neutrality is kind of just rooted in free markets and anti-regulation. I mean, looking at, you know, what Trump's administration has done across all regulatory agencies has been pretty consistent in that they've just been repealing rules and deregulating the, you know, corporations left and right across, you know, environmental, labor, education, FDA. So we're seeing, like, across all regulatory agencies a move to deregulate and give corporations as much power as possible. And this is really just an extension of that ideology. But this is about our information. And so it's going to be really hard to know what's going on anywhere if we don't have, you know, at least some sort of openness or some sort of level playing field for how we're able to access news about what's going on in the world.
Well, and Ajit Pai also was an attorney with Verizon, so presumably he would have really been steeped in that company's perspective on this issue. Do you think that's correct?
You know, I can't say what influences him there or not, because looking at Tom Wheeler, he was also worked for the wireless lobbying group. Tom Wheeler was the chairman of the FCC under Obama, and he did end up actually enshrining net neutrality and keeping those principles, or rather kind of fortifying and codifying those principles into policy. But that wasn't, you know, Wheeler was convinced of that eventually. It wasn't his initial decision. He was convinced of that after immense public pressure. One thing I didn't say is that when it came to the public interacting on this issue and getting involved with this issue, both in 2014 when the rules were originally passed and then again in 2017, 2018 when the rules were being rescinded, the FCC broke records for U.S. history in terms of public participation. So, you know, in 2017, 22 million comments were filed to the FCC in this rather kind of obscure regulatory rulemaking docket. And it's because people really, really care. It's also because there were a lot of automated comments put in. It was a very kind of corrupted process. But even when you discount the automated comments, the bots, the comments from, you know, using stolen identities, it was just rife with all kinds of abuse. We still have broken records in U.S. history, and it just shows that people are absolutely concerned with the idea of corporations having control over what information they can access.
Well, also, I know HBO comedian news host John Oliver also made this a big issue, and I think he had a website, Go FCC Yourself or something like that, that got his users very riled up. Was that a factor in getting people engaged in this net neutrality debate?
Yeah, John Oliver had a 20-minute segment on it, and he asked people to get involved. And, of course, after that, they actually crashed the FCC's website because they weren't used to getting that much participation. But it wasn't just John Oliver. It was, all kinds of celebrities were getting involved with this. And this wasn't just, you know, an issue. It wasn't like advocates against corporations. A lot of corporations were pro this as well. You know, the large internet companies were in favor of this as well. So it's typically we see consumer advocates kind of rallying against these large internet companies because of their privacy violations or the way they handle, you know, disinformation or hate speech. We actually saw a lot of convergence here of people saying, wait, no matter what your issue area is, no matter what you care about, if this isn't the most important thing to you, it should be the second most important thing because nobody's going to know what it is that you care most about without access to information.
So if you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're talking about net neutrality and a recent court decision this week that upheld Trump administration rollback of an Obama-era regulation that preserved net neutrality and enshrined net neutrality. And we're joined by Slate technology writer April Glazer to discuss this court ruling. We'd love to hear from you if you want to join this conversation. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on our website at yourcallradio.org. Well, April, let me ask you about the lawsuit then. What was the source of the lawsuit? Who was filing it? What were their arguments? And what are the implications now that it's been presumably put to rest now in the D.C. Court of Appeal? And I'm assuming there's no appeal to the Supreme Court at this point.
It's certainly possible that there will be an appeal to the Supreme Court. I would be surprised if there isn't later on down the road, but, you know, this just happened early this week. But the lawsuit was a collection of all of the groups, including 22 state attorneys generals, a handful of consumer advocacy groups, all kinds of folks who companies who were all interested in fighting and challenging the FCC's repeal, you know, saying that this that the FCC's repeal was, you know, pushed through, that it happened too quickly after the original rules were already passed. There was also a point about the comment process being so corrupt, and that this was just kind of like rammed through the agency and without really a reason for rescinding these rules, because the old rules hadn't been on the books for that long and there was so much public support around them. But the courts did rule that the FCC did in fact did do this correctly, that there was nothing that should be necessarily undone about the undoing of these rules. But one thing that they did hold up is that states have the ability to pass their own, you know, net neutrality rules to govern how the internet is used within their states. And that's something that they did protect, because essentially what the FCC did when they rescinded the net neutrality rules was say that the FCC doesn't have the authority to regulate the internet in this way. And so when the FCC kind of took away its own authority to regulate the internet, and that was kind of the mechanism through which it undid these internet protection rules, it said that then states do have the authority to do so. And so if the FCC doesn't have the authority, states do. And California last year did pass a law, nine other states have passed similar laws and executive orders protecting net neutrality in the state. And because of the relatively borderless nature of the internet, you know, it's not like the internet changes when you cross state lines. When one state has a rule governing how the internet works in it, particularly the most populous state in the country like California, then that kind of sets the standard for the internet across the country. And so California's net neutrality rules could end up being the de facto internet regulations for the nation.
Well, that seemed to me like a pretty big silver lining in this decision for those who care about net neutrality, that it does preserve California's legislation. So, and potentially other states now might be encouraged to pass their own laws. But how would that work exactly if California is, as you mentioned, this big part of the market, if they have net neutrality, but, you know, other states don't? And I gather there's there are other states, there's nine other states that do have their own net neutrality laws as well. So for those, you know, non-nine states that don't have net neutrality laws, how would an internet service provider manage that? Is that even technologically feasible to have different standards in different states when it comes to something as kind of, as non-concrete as the internet?
Right. No, I'm not sure if it's technologically possible to balkanize how we access the internet across the United States, state by state. But it's difficult, and it's much easier to just have one internet that's the World Wide Web that operates the same way across the country. What has happened before when we have internet rules that originate in California is that those are the standards that are set up across the country. So, for example, the idea of having a privacy policy on your website, that came from California, and now that's kind of the standard across the country, right? It's a California law that websites have to have this.
And the EU as well. EU has the privacy disclosures.
Yeah, but the privacy policy kind of link or the disclosure that we've had for years came from California, but it's not the same thing, and EU is much more strict. But I will answer your question, say that California could set the standards because, you know, it's going to be very burdensome for internet companies to have one internet in California, another internet in Tennessee, another internet in Vermont. And you know, they'll probably have to go with the strictest rules, which is the California set, in order to operate.
So that seems like a positive development then, that if, for those who might be despairing that net neutrality is gone, that we essentially now have a California standard that could in practice become a national standard. But currently for those nine states like Hawaii and Montana and New York that do have their own net neutrality rules, how do they differ at all? And if so, how?
They do differ. And the California rules are actually the strongest rules by far. The California rules also prohibit practices like zero rating, which is when an internet company or a wireless phone company decides to give free access to certain applications that kind of don't discount against your data policies, therefore privileging those. So, for example, if T-Mobile gives free access to Spotify, then you're probably not going to be using another music streaming service, and that like clearly disadvantages them. And makes it much harder for new entrants to come into the market. So that's banned. That's considered a non-neutral practice, which sounds healthy to me. The California rule also bans internet providers from neglecting to keep up their networks in order to disadvantage or kind of force more payment from other internet providers or web service providers. And these are kind of internet connection agreements that kind of help the internet run and make sure that we're, you know, exchanging data fairly. And so the California law is pretty thorough and covers a lot of bases that, you know, even goes farther than the original Obama-era net neutrality rules do. But, you know, the mechanisms through which these laws came into being are quite different, too. The California law is a law. In other states, we see executive orders that have been passed. And those orders, like in Montana, as you mentioned, or New Jersey, actually say that if an internet company wants to do business with contracts in the state, so if an internet company wants to service public schools or state government in some way, then they have to provide net neutrality or non-discriminatory service for all the residents in the state. And that's another way that states have kind of, you know, pulled a lever there to ensure that the people who live in those states are you know, using a neutral, non-discriminatory internet. It's a bit different than a law. But it's just, you know, another way that, you know, legislatures have tried to protect their constituents.
So federalism in action here on this issue. I want to get into the politics a bit about this. Is this a bipartisan issue? I mean, I've heard that this really could affect rural communities in different ways. Those tend to be more conservative. What are the sort of the politics of this from urban and rural, from cities to states? What do you see on that front?
So you're asking the partisan issues here. So, I mean,
yeah,
we have
is this a is. Yeah.
No, sorry.
I was going to say, is this a partisan issue? Does it split along, you know, geographic divides, given the impacts to rural customers versus urban customers? Curious about your view on that.
A few points there. You know, we do have a law or a bill, rather, that did pass in the House and has seen some Republican support. It's probably going to die in the Senate, although I hope it doesn't. It's the Save the Internet Act that would enshrine net neutrality, kind of codify it as a federal law. And it's also unlikely that Trump would sign it. But we did see it pass in the House. It's now waiting for the Senate. Mitch McConnell said it's dead on arrival. So there you have it. But there's been Republican senators in the recent past, last year, you know, a good handful that have come out in favor of net neutrality, saying that, you know, this is something that we need to protect markets, to protect our access to information. And so it's not necessarily a super partisan issue. We definitely see people who consider themselves more on the libertarian side of things pro net neutrality often as well. But when it comes to the urban-rural thing, you know, this is something that people care about no matter where they live. And it's because people need access to the internet no matter where they live. If you're in a rural area, sometimes the internet is your only way to know what's going on. It's kind of your lifeline to information nationally. It's how you figure out what's happening. And so people absolutely care about this in rural areas and in urban areas too. And one thing that I want to underscore with all of this is that, like, yes, net neutrality is super, super important, but in the United States now, over 25% of Americans still do not have reliable access to broadband internet. And that is in rural areas and in urban areas. And, you know, one of the things that kind of compounds the net neutrality issue further is that most people in the United States, the vast majority, only have one or two choices when it comes to broadband internet at all. So there's already this massive lack of competition. So it's not like we're going to see AT&T and Verizon competing for giving better service and having neutral practices over each other.
All right. Well, April Glazer, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. April Glazer, who is a Slate technology writer, talking about Obama-era net neutrality rollbacks. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And to listen to this or past shows and sign up for our podcast, please visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. And you can follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.